Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Silvercrest conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the speaker's presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session. To ask a question during this session, you will need to press star then one on your telephone. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. If you require any further assistance, please press star then zero. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speakers for today, Richard Huff, Chairman and CEO, and Robert Teeter, Head of Investment Policy and Strategy Group. You may begin.
Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us today for a discussion with all of Silvercrest's fixed income portfolio management team. In addition to Robert Teeter, who's joining me, Rob is head of the Investment Policy and Strategy Group. He's been working with Silvercrest on asset allocation and manager selection, as well as macroeconomic issues since 2003 and formally joined the firm just about 6 years ago. We're also joined by Patrick Bittner. Patrick is a founding member of the firm and a partner. He's been with us since 2002, and he manages exempt fixed income portfolios for both our high net worth and institutional clients. Prior to that, he was at Credit Suisse managing fixed income bonds. Russell Brown is a senior vice president, and he is the overseer of our taxable fixed income account. He joined us in 2005, so many of our fixed income team have been with us for well over a decade. We're also joined by our high-yield municipal team. Buck Stevenson is a managing director. He's been at the firm since 2005 as well, and prior to that was 9 years as a head trader and manager of the municipal bond department at Max Corp Financial. His partners and colleagues, Ed Appel, is a managing director on the municipal value strategy of high yield bond. He also joined us in 2005 when we put that effort together, and he spent 9 years as the director of research of the bond department at Max Corp Financial Group as well. Importantly, and we'll get to this later, Ed served as the CFO of a hospital, and we often invest in healthcare, which is certainly of great interest to our investors these days. And finally, Doug Stevenson joins us, also a managing director and partner at the firm, who joined us in 2005, and he too spent 9 years at Max Corp Financial Group as the generalist in the municipal bond market. So thanks so much for joining us. Rob, this is an unprecedented, in many respects, time for the fixed income markets, perhaps maybe only matched by the great financial crisis 10, 11 years ago. What are we seeing today, and what do we hope to accomplish with this call on behalf of our investors?
Yeah, it certainly is unprecedented, Rick, and there's been a significant amount of volatility in the fixed income markets. As you point out, some of it at levels similar to what we've seen in the crisis, and others, while not quite there, pretty close to it. So I'll give a very brief background to set some context, and then we'd like to very quickly transition to the experts that we have on the call here today and start getting their views as to what they're seeing in their respective markets and what types of securities they're owning and purchasing on behalf of clients. So a couple of things to keep in mind. As many of us know, the U.S. 10-year Treasury bond trades at a rate of about 60 basis points now. That's been a pretty significant move and is indicative of some of the risk-off nature of what's gone on in markets here. From the economic side, the backdrop has seen two very significant developments. One, demand disruption from the shutdowns that have taken place in the economy due to the coronavirus, and the second being very significant amounts of stimulus from both the Fed, the Treasury, and Congress as well. And so the net result of all of this is there are a lot of cross currents, which makes things even more confusing than normal. However, as it relates to rates and bonds, I would say that we don't see inflation being imminent here, although we'll talk a little bit about what the TIPS market or the inflation protected bonds market has to say about that. Overall, we think this is an environment that should very much reward security specific credit work. And we think that this is something that should be core to what everyone is doing, and that's what our teams here are doing, and that's what we'll begin to talk about shortly. If you look back to late February, credit spreads began to widen out very quickly. They've since improved somewhat, recovering about half the move, although it varies somewhat by segment. So with that, we'll begin to turn some questions over to our teams here. One of the first things that we've noticed is that, as is typical in many crises, the global financial crisis was one example of this, and we saw it play out in February and March here, is fear of access to funding. And so while markets have been pretty choppy, there has been a lot of action taken by the Fed and Treasury, and that's been somewhat beneficial in the near term. But first, I thought we'd turn to Russell Brown, who, as you mentioned, Rick, focuses on corporate bonds, and ask Russell to give us an update on how companies are obtaining access to capital here and what types of rates they're paying for it. So, Russell, perhaps you could start off with an overview of that.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. To give you a review of what happened with the credit markets, they went from fairly expensive at the beginning of the year. After all, the stock market was up, so spreads were fairly tight. Then, as the coronavirus news hit, the fear factor hit. The primary market, which is the new debt sales market by corporations, shut down by the end of February. In early March, you had some of the lower volatility issuers come to market. Those are your household names that everyone knows. However, the tide was pretty much still going out. Anything that you bought seemed to be wider the next day. And that really centered around two main concerns: solvency and the ability to refinance maturing debt. Now, a few things happened in the time frame which did have big effects on the market. Now, the first was on the 15th of March, the Federal Reserve did an emergency rate cut from 1.25% to the range of 0 to 0.25%, with the statement that they would do whatever it takes to support the Treasury and the agency mortgage market. That was a big move, but it didn't pacify the credit markets. Over the next couple of weeks, the average spread on corporate bonds almost tripled from 93 basis points on February 21st to 287 on March 23rd. That represents an unrealized loss of almost 10%. Now, over time, you did see a repricing, and eventually around the 19th of March, issues that were brought to market were really priced to sell, and buyers responded. You had cases of good names were issuing debt in the high 200 basis points to mid 300 basis points versus treasuries. Now, with only a few exceptions, the all-in rates that companies were paying to issue debt wasn't onerous, okay? Bat Capital, the old British American Tobacco Company, they issued 30-year debt. They were among one of the highest rates that they had to pay, and it was still under 5.5%. Now, as the primary market started to generate gains, the secondary market for corporate bonds started to improve a lot as well. There was a lot more trading. It was a lot more efficient. Then there was a big move on April 9th, and that was when the Fed instituted their muni liquidity facility, the Main Street Lending Facility, the expansion of primary and secondary Market Corp credit facilities, and also the Term Asset Back Program to as much as $850 billion. Less affected industries then saw their debt sales very well received, and spreads were progressively tighter on new issues. Now, there are some industries that were, I consider, severely affected: airlines, retailing, and lodging. And they did have to pay a higher price to refinance debt than other companies. The most extreme were Carnival Cruise Lines. They issued a 3-year at 11.5%, and Kohl's issued a 5-year at 9.5%. Now, as Rob mentioned earlier, with all these programs being brought and a better appetite, you saw about a 50% retracement in spreads, which currently stand at about 191 basis points. And that's mainly because refinancing risk has largely abated. Now, where are we now? You've got a case of most triple B issuers, which are still investment grade, are paying well under 4% for issuing 30-year debt. Most A issuers are paying below 3%. And to give you an idea of what kind of move we had, Coca-Cola and Pepsi both sold 10-year debt yesterday at a yield to them of 167. For Pepsi, that represented a spread 75 basis points tighter than they issued on March 17th. With Coke, it was 150 basis points tighter than the deal they sold on March 20th. And to give you an example of where we are today, Norfolk Southern, which is a Baa1 BBB plus railroad, they're going to sell 30-year debt just over a yield of 3%. Mondelez, which is also Baa1 but BBB by S&P, is issuing a 5-year, and their yield is going to be under a 160, and their 10-year is going to be around a 205. I guess people still like Oreo cookies. Now, what we've been doing here at Silvercrest is we've been buying industries that I consider operating. They may be marginally affected, but they're basically still in business. UPS had come with a 5-year deal in March at about a spread of 312 basis points or a yield of 370. Similar situation was with FedEx. They brought a 5-year, which came at 350 basis points or a 380. Currently, the UPS bond is trading around 110 basis points over Treasuries, and the FedEx is trading around 220. Just over a week and a half ago, I bought a 10-year issue for Sunoco Products, which is rated mid-triple B, which came at a 3 1/8. That's an issuer that I consider a lower beta triple B, in that even though it has the kind of rating that it does, it's just not going to have the spread volatility of, let's say, one of the auto companies or some industry like that. I've also bought 1.5 to 3-year first mortgage paper of utilities at spreads from anywhere from 150 to 225 basis points versus Treasuries. Most of those are now well inside 100 basis points. Now, at this point in time, I'm continuing to favor the aforementioned what I call marginally affected names. Again, these are companies who may be seeing that their volumes are down, maybe their costs are up, but they're still operating reasonably normal. And the main reason for that is we're still not sure of what kind of a time horizon we're going to have for a recovery and what type of a recovery is we're going to have. So don't know necessarily what's going to happen in about 2 or 3 months. I really don't want to own an issue that I would say has bought themselves time for the next few months, but still faces substantial business risk. I've been moving more towards shorter issues on the yield curve as all-in yields tend to fall. So a lot of the issues that I'm buying may be in the 1.25% to 1.5% yield area. I will buy new issues that are of a longer maturity if I feel that they are attractively priced by the market. Now, earlier there was the question about inflation. Now, the TIPS market, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, is currently expecting deflation for the next 2 years on the order of 0.3%. 5-year TIPS currently say that we're going to have inflation just under 0.8% for the next 5 years, while 10 years is around 1.12%. Now, I just want to remind you that the average CPI has been about 1.8% for the last 10 years, so those estimates are substantially under what history has been. Now, the one thing is, as far as inflation goes, energy is a big component of the CPI. And, of course, we've been hearing what's been going on with oil prices and gasoline. And we do expect that there will be a hit to CPI. However, it's really hard to imagine extended pressure on this. And then the other thing is, most of the governments around the world, including ours, are going to have large-scale financing needs. It may be very difficult to avoid inflation unless a recovery is really real on the sluggish side. And that's basically all I have.
Thank you, Russell. You covered
covered a lot of ground there. Certainly happy to hear that the companies have access to the capital markets and that it's creating some opportunity for you in terms of the types of things you're buying on the corporate bond side.
Yes, that was really the big thing, that the refinancing risk has largely been put aside for now.
I am curious, Russell, that given the massive liquidity being put into the market by both the Fed and the Treasury, the inflation concerns that you briefly mentioned are high on the mind of a lot of investors, especially those with substantial savings in the fixed income market. And you referred to the TIPS market, what we're seeing now. Is that going to be one of your primary indicators looking forward, along with assessing the deflationary trends that we're seeing in sectors like energy, or are there other aspects of the market that will be your guide as we continue to guide our investors into the future?
It's going to be something I'll be paying a decent amount of attention to, but certainly not only, because it will be as much a general economic picture aside from energy. Again, if the recovery is somewhat sluggish, you know, companies may not be able to pass along price increases even if they want to. But again, if oil stays at a very low level, you could have a domino effect from that, obviously, on, you know, all the big oil producers. That's going to be a concern, and that could, you know, have ripple effects through the economy.
Thanks very much. I appreciate that. I think now we'll move on to Patrick Bittner, who again focuses on investment grade municipals, which is an awfully important sector for our taxable clients, and there's certainly no shortage of challenges there. And we've even seen the Fed now introduce a municipal lending facility. I'm curious, Patrick, what you can share about the investment-grade municipal bond market and where we're trading.
Well, I'd like to sort of just first go back and just remind everybody, you know, a month ago, everything was fine. Unemployment rate, 2 months ago, unemployment rate was low. We were in the middle of the longest economic expansion in history. State and local municipalities were stockpiling reserves, and money is flowing to mutual funds at a record pace. And then it all stopped. Stocks started going down 10-20%, and then people started looking for assets that they could sell, and muni bonds are one of the few assets that hadn't been declining. So people started selling them, and then we had a problem where the leveraged mutual funds had to sell. They're forced to liquidate, and this forced selling hit the market at a time when just weren't enough buyers. We saw interest rates rise about 200 basis points, 2%, in less than 10 days. And we had a full-blown liquidity crisis. And like Russell said, the Federal Reserve stepped in, the Treasury stepped in and took some actions to reassure markets and unfreeze them. And then now, you know, 2 months later, here we are, the muni market has stabilized with interest rates quickly falling 1.5% as buyers recognize the great value corrected by the sell-off. New issues are being priced at a normal pace. Bonds are trading in the secondary market. The bid-ask spread, which is the difference from what a bond is worth and what a broker is willing to pay for it, has widened, but that's what happens during all recessions. Credit spreads, as Russell mentions, have widened, but that, as usual, happens in the pre-recession period. All in all, we're in a normal sort of pre-recession, early recession market. But what isn't normal is the speed and depth in which changes are occurring. Usually a recession unfolds over a 1-2 year period, not 1 to 2 months. As in every recession, we're currently hearing headlines are heralding doom and despair. Now, state revenues will be down, local revenues will be down, sales taxes are falling, property taxes will be under stress, and personal income taxes are falling. Credits will be downgraded, but I really want to point out that there's a big difference between a downgrade in credit quality and bankruptcy. The good thing about investment-grade municipal bonds is that they're really high on the investment-grade scale, and they're a long distance away from bankruptcy, so most creds can take 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 downgrades before they even have it being threatened, a threat of being going to bankruptcy. So, like I said, we're pretty much in a normal pre-recession, early recession market.
You know,
so,
Patrick,
one of the types of questions we've received, unsurprisingly, given our office headquarters in New York, is some of the specific challenges faced in the New York area and other areas like it. We're wondering if you might comment on that a bit.
Yeah, I mean, New York is lucky in that it's been well run financially. The pension plan is almost fully funded. They had about $5 billion in general reserves in the fund. They had $2-3 billion in their rainy day fund, which is extra money they set aside to use in case there is an economic downturn. And the other nice thing about New York is that they have an April budget period. Most municipalities have a fiscal year that goes from June 30 to June 30. New York is one of the few that starts in April. And the good news was that they passed the budget in April. They cut spending going into this year, this fiscal year, by $6-7 billion, and gave Governor Cuomo the authority to cut spending even more if he sees fit. So a lot of times he doesn't have to go back to the legislative and get approval to do it. So New York is actually doing really well, just because they came into it, their pensions almost fully funded and a good level of reserves, and they have the budget flexibility right now to handle lower revenues.
So Patrick, on that point, municipals have seen something like a 10% drop over the past month, and while they're highly rated AA+ or A quality, there is some concern that if the federal government doesn't supply some aid, that you're risking, maybe perhaps not in New York, but in a lot of other municipalities or states, defaults or bankruptcies. Although that's a question. How is it that you're evaluating the safety of those revenue bonds going forward?
Well, first of all, I would sort of disagree with you. I think for the investment credits, like the AAA, AA, single A bonds, they have enough flexibility in their budgets. The nice thing about municipal bonds versus corporations is they usually tend to have general reserves on their books. Single A credits usually have about 10% reserve, general reserves. Double A credits have about 20% reserves, and triple A's have more. So you're looking at maybe revenues dropping 10%. Well, they have that money already as a general reserve. But usually municipalities will do is what they'll do what they always do. They will cut budget. They will lay off people. They will fire people. They'll put job freezes on. They'll cut services. This is not the first recession we've been through, right? We had the dot-com bubble bursting, people on the Northeast. We had the 9/11 crisis, and we all went through the Great Recession a couple of years ago. So Most of the management of these municipalities have already been through this. Yes, this is a lot faster and deeper than the Great Recession, but the good news, again, is that reserves were at record levels. We went into the Great Recession with reserves about maybe 5% in the municipal market, and now we're averaging about, I think the average reserve was – reserves were 8% going into this crisis. So,
and of course, you made a distinction, of course, as well between the different sovereignties. I mean, it just looking where a lot of our investors are, they're in 46 states, of course, and you're investing across the country. But we have a concentration in the Southeast and the Northeast. But are there some particular areas that you're watching especially carefully, and what are you looking for?
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is. I mean, you're right. I deal in 50 different states, and each state is different. The good news is, like in the Southeast, our Virginia, Maryland, and North Carolina clients, those are really good, strong states. New York is strong. At the tri-state region, you have the good, bad, and the ugly, right? The good is New York. The bad is Connecticut. Connecticut has not really done a really good job of taking care of their pensions, but their new governor has done some really good financial, fiscally things. He cut the amount of debt that he was issuing. He increased the rainy day fund. I think Connecticut has about a $2 billion rainy day fund, and they think that this year's budget deficit might be about $500 million. So the good news is that, the bad news is revenues are down. The good news is that they have the reserves to cover it. So he's been doing well. And then the ugly is New Jersey. I mean, they haven't been their pension. But just because the state isn't doing well, a lot of the local municipalities are doing well. So Jersey's one of those states that we're going to watch very closely. Citibank just did an analysis of the state and said that, while they wouldn't be adding the positions right now, they don't see any reason to sell Jersey GOs or Jersey appropriated paper. I'm in that camp also, and I think we need to wait and see.
Yeah, and then of course you've got your selective active management and security selection at the municipal level, as you pointed out.
Right. I mean, one of the ways we're going about it right now is, again, we're dusting off our recession playbook just like the federal government did it, right? What we're trying to do right now is keep it safe, keep it short, keep it simple. We're buying pre-funded bonds, which are muni bonds that are backed by government collateral, by government securities as collateral. I'm sticking to the AAA names and the AA and the high AA names. I'm not really even buying any single A credits. The idea is that, you know, you're waiting for a buying opportunity. You want to keep things safe right now. You want to keep your portfolios liquid. You want to review your credits that you have, make sure that everything's, you know, acting the way you think it should. And then hopefully at some point in time you'll get an opportunity to extend portfolios and to buy credits at wider spreads than they are right now.
So, Patrick, one of the other shorter-term considerations here has been another unprecedented action, which has been the delay in tax payment deadlines for individuals. How are you helping people navigate the shorter-term liquidity needs between now and July tax payments?
Well, that's an easier one, because normally what we try to do is we try to buy bonds maturing in April for most of our clients that have tax liabilities, something we can immunize. And April is a hard time to find bonds. Aren't that many bonds issued? But because the fiscal year for most municipalities start June 30th, there are a lot of bonds that mature June 1st, June 15th, and July 1st. So what we've been doing for a lot of people is we're just rolling their April 1st money into July 1st bonds. And right now, munis are cheap. I mean, Treasury bills that due in July are probably yielding 0.1%, and I can get anywhere from 0.8 to 1.2% in bonds are maturing 7/1/2000. I mean, two-year munis right now, AAA munis, are yielding four times more than Treasury bonds are. Rick mentioned before 10-year Treasuries are at 60, well, 10-year AAA munis are at a 150. So the good news is that I can find the paper to help these clients out, and the better news is that it's a very cheap way of doing it.
Great. Thank you, Patrick. That's very helpful.
That's encouraging in terms of very helpful in how we're helping our clients navigate this towards a tax deadline. We hate it, but, of course, that's also where the revenue for municipals comes from. Also joining us today, as I mentioned earlier, is the high-yield municipal team, and Doug Stevenson, and Ed Appel specialize in issues, tax-free municipals that are supporting essential services in communities such as regional hospitals or senior living or educational facilities. And as we've seen lately in this crisis, how important healthcare can be, and in many respects, how fragile it can be, and often serves single communities. In New York City, where, of course, we have the center of the current crisis, has one of the largest health systems in the country, but many of the places we invest in may only have a single regional hospital, and this team does original credit work. And I thought we'd hear from them, given the widening in spreads, what they're seeing in the higher yield market to support these institutions, and we'll discuss their strategy in this environment after that. So I'll turn it over to you, Buck.
Thank you very much, Rick. Thank you, everyone, for taking the time to join us this afternoon. What I'd like to start with is a little overview of what we do. We focus on two essential aspects of the high yield market and every community, and that is healthcare and education. Both are critical to each community that we live in. And with that, in the healthcare sector, there's two components that we focus on: hospital bonds, acute care hospital bonds, and continuing care retirement facilities, senior living facilities. And both are very different. And what I'd like to do is give you an example of a type of a hospital we like to buy. It's a 200-bed hospital located in Ward County, and it is the only hospital for 100 miles. So it is essential, it's critical, it exists. It's very well financed, has a very strong balance sheet, and so far, they have not been overrun by any of the virus issues. So when you read some of the articles concerning the New York City hospitals, it doesn't play out like that throughout the hospital sector. There's over 5,000 not-for-profit hospitals throughout the country, and each one is different. Each has different demographics. And so there isn't one brush that paints the hospital sector, which you tend to get the impression of when you read the articles. So it's very important to realize that. Another interesting hospital is in Kentucky. It is designated the sole community provider, acknowledging that it needs to be there. They get better reimbursement from our government because of that designation. It's interesting, middle part of Kentucky, there's over 50 major manufacturing, some top 500, Fortune 500 companies are there. And so it is very well financed also by a nice balance sheet. Both of these credits we see having no problem at the moment. None of them have had the issues of being overwhelmed that many of the urban centers have, which is one of the things I want to point out is what we don't invest in. We really don't invest in the urban centers. We like to have what we view as almost a monopoly. The urban centers have safety net hospitals. These are the ones that tend to get overrun. That is what we avoid. So it's very important to understand what we do, but also what we don't do. We also don't invest in malls, convention centers, tobacco bonds. Some of these things are as important as what we do to stay away from the things that may have challenging finances during recessions. Most all of our credits have been in existence, some of them for 100 years. So they've weathered many economic cycles. Now I'd like to go into the senior living, the continuing care retirement facilities. We read many articles about senior living centers, and they all talk about what's going on, which is very hard to read. It's very disturbing. But I want to point out they're really not naming it the right thing. These are nursing homes. Nursing homes are a sector of our market we do not invest in. It's one of the sectors that is actually dominated by the for-profit and private owners, not by the not-for-profit 501c3s. So a lot of the things we all read are very disturbing, but it is not the sector that we invest in. I'll give you two examples of some senior living centers that we do invest in. One is in Illinois. It's in Bloomington, Illinois. They have about 200 independent living units on a 40-acre campus. They've been in existence since 1979. They also then provide assisted living and then skilled nursing if need be. But those two segments are much smaller than the independent living. They received $1.7 million from the payment protection plan that was enacted here, indicating how important they are. They have over 300 days cash on hand, so they're well financed. And to this date, they've had no COVID-19 patients sick. So there's many facilities like this around the country that are not in financial distress, nor do we anticipate them getting into financial stress. We view this as money good. It is one of the first questions we ask when we look at a credit. Is the credit money good? Does it need to be there? What role does it play? Those are important fundamental questions that we go through on every investment we own.
Buck,
also,
to take a moment to give people some insight into the team that you work with and how you've approached that detailed work that you're just starting to talk about.
Our team has been together for about 30 years, actually. We have really picked the sectors that we feel grab the most amount of interest with the least amount of risk. Interest rate, I should say, the best returns. And so Edipel, well, we met in 1995, and at the time, you know, he was at Lehman Brothers, and he focused on hospital bonds. He was actually rated the number one healthcare analyst back then for hospital bonds. So we're very good at what we do. We really know how to focus on it, and we try to cherry pick those couple hundred, you know, hospitals, the 5,000 that meet all of our criteria. One of the metrics that we use in purchasing bonds is we make sure we're senior secured, that there's nobody in front of us. The collateral, the property, plant, and equipment are what help back our bonds if we need it. But we very much hope that that's not going to be the case, and that generally is not the case. All of our credits, go ahead.
Yeah, on that point, and kind of what you're looking for and the deep experience of your team, you mentioned Ed's role in evaluating healthcare companies and nonprofit organizations. He was a hospital CFO, as we've discussed. A lot of this work is the kind of bottom-up credit work. You're looking at to make sure that there's a wide moat around the facility, that it's essential to the community it serves, that you're first in line, that it's well collateralized, et cetera. But once you've invested in it and you're facing an environment like this where you have the widening spread, you have revenue risk potentially, how is it that you are undertaking an ongoing review of your credit in the portfolios, and what are the risks that currently exist in the portfolio?
A very good question, especially during this period right now. What is misunderstood sometimes is that because we invest in what is generally viewed as smaller 501c3 not-for-profits, that it might be hard to get information. It actually isn't. They are run like small businesses. They use GAAP accounting. They report quarterly. You can access on some of the NERMSRs, which are three data centers that all of our credits need to report their financial information to. How they report is part of the covenant of the bond deal when they came to market. So they are mandated to give us this financial data on a quarterly minimum and then an audited annual statement. On top of that, we hold calls with management. Bondholders will use the bond trustee, reach out to the facility, and schedule phone calls frequently, especially during times like this, to get an up-to-date read on exactly what's going on with the facility. So access to information is key, and we have that ability to monitor each of our credits. So that's a very good question.
Great. Buck, maybe if you could give us a little bit of an overview of what a typical portfolio might look like in terms of the type of yield or income that it's generating now, recognizing that, you know, much of what we and you do is customized. But just give us a sense of what a portfolio might look like in today's environment.
Certainly. With our separately managed accounts, we are able to try to customize to one's own risk, meaning you can have a 5-year duration or you can have a 10-year duration, depending on what you like. On average, we have about a 7-year duration. We can provide someone with approximately a 5 to 5.5% tax-exempt rate at this current market. We were struggling to find that prior to this correction. This correction has opened up an opportunity, and an opportunity because when the crisis, liquidity crisis hit, and it was a liquidity crisis, not a credit crisis, everything got painted with the same brush. So when one fund who was leveraged and they had to unwind started selling, a lot of people started to worry about what's going to happen to hospital bonds, what's going to happen to senior living centers. And so as that fund sold a bond, the evaluators viewed that trade to represent all the bonds in that sector. We all got painted with the same brush. And that really is not how it works. Each credit is different. We saw this in 2008, and we were able to purchase some really nice buys, some of the best buys of our career during the fourth quarter of 2008. And sure enough, by 2009, as things settled, all of the credits we bought really rebounded sharply. We were able to make all of it back in a short period of time because we had really quality stories.
Is that, Buck, effectively the environment you're seeing now? I mean, you know, you've discussed how good the credits are, that they're not impaired, that you believe that they're sound and will continue paying at this nice rate, and yet there's been a significant drawdown in the high yield portfolio recently, and is that primarily due to a sell-off in the market generally and without distinction, as you're saying? And
Rick, that's exactly right. You're exactly right. They did not make any distinction amongst credits. They viewed things as one broad brush of healthcare. And so that's exactly when we like to take advantage of these efficiencies. One thing I like to point out is municipals are different than many other fixed income markets. We have 1 million different securities in existence, over 50,000 different issuers. So it's inefficient. The evaluators can't possibly get to each bond individually at this point. They will over time. So right now we can purchase what someone may think is not a healthy bond, and it actually is. We know the bond, we follow it, and we can buy it at these cheaper prices. So this is exactly when I like to take advantage of this inefficiency going on.
And how often in the portfolio are you holding your issues to maturity?
We try to do that on most every purchase. The only reason we would sell is, number one, we don't like the fundamentals and the credit not performing. Or, number two, the credit has been bought out by a better rated entity. We've had price appreciation, and we can reinvest in a better opportunity. Those are the two reasons. Otherwise, we like to hold the bond, clip our coupon, and hold it to maturity.
Mm-hmm. So, in many respects, you're holding it to maturity, getting that yield, and then using these price dislocations that are indiscriminate to make better purchases.
Exactly.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks. Rob,
another
do you have anything else?
Go ahead.
I
wanted to make one other point.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
You know, you're going to read in the papers about pension obligations. Patrick talked about it for Connecticut. It's also very important to know all of our businesses do not have pension problems. They are either fully funded or almost fully funded. They are on a defined contribution, not a defined benefit. And that's significant. So our credits many times are healthier than sometimes the state that they reside in.
That's very interesting. Well, whether we're talking about the municipal credits issued directly by states or municipalities, or we're talking about your higher yielding bonds that invest in specific essential services, these issues and the money that is obtained by floating these credits supports vital services in our communities. And I'm just so pleased that we have a team that both for the municipal and state credits that Patrick specializes in on behalf of our clients, and your team is part of what helps make this country function and will help in many respects pull us through this environment. And it's great to be in many respects a part of that story. Rob, unless you've got something else, I think we might open up the lines to any callers who may have questions.
I think that's a great idea. We've covered a lot of ground here.
Great. Operator, we'll take questions now from anyone on the line.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder to ask a question, you will need to press star then one on your telephone. To withdraw your question, press the pound key. Again, that's star one to ask the question. Please stand by while we compile the Q&A roster.
Thank you. We'll just give a moment for those questions to come in. While we wait for that, and I was talking about these services, whether they're from the state or municipality, I think you might find it interesting that in this environment, many of the schools we invest in are serving meals, not just to their own students, but to students in the community. And so in many respects, we view these investments, whether it's in healthcare, charter schools, as community assets that are truly social impact investments, which have gotten a lot of attention over the past few years. And in many respects, our firm doesn't view investing in the state and municipal issue bonds any differently, given the services those entities provide us in our communities. Do we have any questions in the queue?
We have a question from the line of Janet Mangano. Your line is open.
Good afternoon.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your comprehensive presentation, each of you. And my question is to each one of you as well, Buck, Patrick, and Russell. Considering the huge differences in the size of the offerings, for example, expecting smaller size in the terms of the small rural hospital and large size when we're considering the corporate issuers, can an individual investor actually make a good purchase in the 100 to 500 bond range, or do we have to pay up to get the kind of quality that we really should be seeking now? Thanks for your response.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for that question. It's a really interesting one. We'll start with you, Patrick.
Thanks, Rick. In this kind of market with the changing economic, I mean, first of all, I think I realize where we're all coming from, right? My job is in the investment-grade portfolios. I play defense. My job is to keep your money safe. My job is to be your anchor to windward, your safe liquid money. So my answer is going to be a little bit different probably than Buck and Doug. And my answer is right now is we don't know what's going to happen, so I'm keeping it safe. I'm paying up to buy the higher credit quality because I think municipal bonds right now, the investment-grade municipal bonds are cheap enough. I'd rather pay up a little bit and lose a little bit of yield but sleep better at night and then have the opportunity a year, 6 months, 8 months, a year down the road to sell that good credit quality bond and buy something a little bit lower credit quality once I understand what the situation is and what's happening.
And Patrick, on that point, what about the distinction for an investor and the block sizes that you can purchase for them versus going into a fund, for example?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the nice thing about individual portfolios is we can gear it towards wherever you are. We can gear it towards the parent who has, you know, $100 million or $5 million or $10 million or the grandchild that only has $100,000, $250,000. Mm-hmm. So nice thing about a mutual fund is you have liquidity. You can sell. The bad thing is you can't control the credits that you're buying. You can't control the timing. My guess is a lot of people that own mutual funds and didn't sell them are going to be hit with big tax bills at the end of the year because when all the mutual funds had redemptions at the beginning of the year, they had sell bonds to take capital gains. So now you're going to be sitting in a mutual fund at the end of the year thinking you're in a municipal bond tax-exempt portfolio and you're going to get this big tax bill. So that's one of the advantages of owning individual securities.
Great.
Thanks, Patrick. Buck, do you have anything to add to this? Of course, your capability is in both a fund format as well as separately managed accounts for investors.
Correct. We have both structures separately managed, which is generally made up of better credits with shorter durations. And then we have our fund, which focuses on gaining the best total return we can. We generally invest in longer bonds at higher yields. So they're both unique in their strategies, and we do like both of them. An interesting point to your question is, you know, and I'm not sure if you meant this, but you don't have to pay up when you invest with Silvercrest. When we buy a bond, that's the price you get it at. You don't have to worry about paying up for anything. So we buy Patrick. Patrick and I are constantly buying bonds at the bid side. So we're saving you money on a lot of our purchases generally.
That's a great point. How many brokers will you go to, Patrick, often when you're looking to purchase an issue?
Currently, since everybody's on electronic platforms, I'm going to 60, 70, 80. You know, back in the old days, you had to call everybody. You dealt with maybe 10, 15 people.
Mm.
But now that it's, you, like I put up what Buck was saying, when I go right now, I go on to Bloomberg, I put a search in, and I'm seeing the whole universe of people offering bonds, even people I don't deal with. Because I see a bond that I like, and I always go to somebody that I do deal with to say, hey, you know, I don't deal with X firm. Can you try to buy that bond for me? But, yeah, typically I'm looking at when I put out bonds for the bids, I'm going to 50, 60 people. And when I'm looking for bonds, I'm probably the whole universe.
Which is helpful also in finding different sized lots. But important,
mm-hmm.
I'm glad you mentioned that because Silvercrest, of course, is just on the bid side and we are not capturing any spread and passing it along to our investors. We're aligned and trying to buy at the best price possible. Do we have other questions in the queue?
Great.
I'm showing no other questions in the queue.
Okay, well, thank you, and thank you for that question. I appreciate you joining us this afternoon to hear from all of our fixed income professionals. It's a very important part of the market that often doesn't get quite the same scrutiny that equity markets do, and we appreciate the opportunity to I'm getting notice here that we've got one more question. So before we close up the call, we're going to take that question. I think it's from Mr. Paul Thompson.
Your line is open, Mr. Thompson.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. One quick question. The Fed has been intervening in all of the markets. One of the areas they've sort of declined to participate in is mortgage servicers. And I'm curious to know if any of you have any views on whether or not they're going to get involved, because I think those guys tend to be undercapitalized relative to the amount of money that they're going to need given the number of people who are out of work and not paying, arguably not paying their mortgages.
Patrick?
Well, I was going to punt it over to Russell since it has more to do with taxable side, even though I don't know they really have expertise in that area. So, Russell?
I'm wondering if we still have
Russell left.
Okay.
Sorry, I hit the button twice. I'm sorry. I'm here. I had hit the button and I didn't realize I had muted it again. I'm sorry. That's not really something which is our area of expertise, but I mean, what you've been hearing, we've been hearing as well. It was really an issue, I'd say, mid-March, okay, because the mortgage market was more of a mess then. Okay, there has been some stability there. A lot of the mortgage REITs were selling, so that was completely throwing off the market and everything. There's been more stabilization there since then. You know, it's hard to speculate about what will be done, though, ultimately, if anything. But you're correct in that. You can't have a lot of these servicers just all of a sudden, you know, disappearing.
Thanks, Tim. Appreciate you calling in. I think we also have a question from Richard Soloway.
Richard, if you'd like to ask the question, please press star then one again. Your line is open.
My question has to do with what are you predicting for the amount of money that's being printed and its effect on bond prices 5 years out or so. Will the chickens come to roost, and will the value of the bonds drop considerably from where they are today when you purchase them?
Rick, I'll take that. I think that's the $10 million question, right? Will this be inflationary? I think we still need to see what's going to happen. Is the Fed going to monetize this debt? Are the deficit hawks going to start winning in Congress and then really clamp down on future spending? It's truly too early to tell, but I think it is a possibility and a concern that, we have to be aware of and watch very carefully in the future that this could finally lead to inflation.
Well, the dollar is going to take a hit, evidently, because you can't print this type of money and not have the dollar lose its purchasing power, which means the bonds that you get today, I would estimate, I'm not an expert on this, would have much less value if you were selling them 5 years or 7 years down the line if they're a 20-year bond. So while the interest generation may be great, the principal, to retrieve the principal, that's going to have a lot less value. I think it's inevitable with this type of situation we're in, don't you?
It could well be. I think this is Rick. That actually remains to be seen, as Patrick was saying, in terms of whether it's actually monetized or printed. The exact same analysis was put forth in the great financial crisis when the Fed opened the floodgates and added massive amounts of credit to their balance sheet in order to buy in instruments from banks. And the great fear was that the multiplier effect of banks loaning out against those credit would generate a large amount of money in circulation, which would inevitably lead to inflation. And it didn't come to pass. It came to pass
from the point of view, if you look at the purchasing power of an 08 dollar to the purchasing power of an 08 dollar today, it's considerably chopped. It doesn't have the same, not in comparison to
history, as inflation was kept quite low and we continue to be in a deflationary environment. I'm not saying that what you're suggesting will come to pass, but it really does remain to be seen, and we'll be watching how the debt and this fiscal stimulus ultimately gets monetized or not. And I think that's the primary answer to your question. We've got a question from Randy Hsu as well on the line, if we could open his line.
Randy, your line is open.
Hi. Thank you for the presentation. I guess I have two more general questions. One is with the Fed. Do you have any indication of what they're focused on buying right now in the market and what that outlook looks like going forward? So tagging on the last question. And then a more general question is, other than the speed, which you mentioned earlier, has there been any other big surprises this time around compared to the previous cycles?
Well, Rick, I'll take the part of that. What the Fed's buying right now is on the muni, investment grade muni side, they start a facility where they're going to start buying bonds from municipalities. They haven't done anything yet because they're still trying to get the paperwork done. They got a $500 billion facility where they're going to buy 1 to 3 year debt from municipalities, cities with population above 250,000, counties with more than 500,000 people, and all the states can borrow money from the Fed. They're still working out how they're going to do that. So to answer your first question, they haven't done anything yet because the Fed wants them first to go to the market, then prove they can't get access to the market, then go to the bank and prove they can't get access to the bank, and then come to the Fed. On the corporate side, I know that there is a buying program. I don't know if they bought anything. They also have programs to support money market funds. They have programs to support commercial paper. Russell, you have any idea if they're doing any buying in that?
Well, I know they've been buying commercial paper. As far as what they've been doing in the corporate market, it's very much unclear. And actually, a story came out the other day is that
they, in their program, they said they would buy the bonds of companies which have principally their employees in the United States. Well, what's principally mean? And apparently BlackRock, who was hired to manage the buying program, is having problems interpreting what to buy too. So the one thing I will also mention is they do release what they bought, but not breaking it out. So you don't know how many corporate bonds they bought, and you don't know what names that they bought, if any. So the thing is that they're there, but they haven't necessarily done that much yet. And sort of like Patrick said with munis, in a way, the markets have kind of taken care of themselves.
Yeah, I think just knowing that the Fed's there is reassuring to the markets. It's not, like Buck said and I mentioned earlier too, that was a liquidity crisis we had earlier when interest rates spiked up, and markets now are functioning. So I don't know if people really need to go to the Fed right now. I'm sure that there will be some people doing it, but right now the markets are functioning.
Thanks, Patrick. Randy, thanks for your question as well as for the compliment. Appreciate that, and I appreciate you and all of our clients and friends joining us for this call. Please stay tuned. Silvercrest will be holding future conferences with other expertise on our team and then perhaps from outside the firm. Thanks again for joining us.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.